before the influence of India and other peoples on this region, that we had to hear, in some of the groups now well advanced, we had a people very similar to the primitive peoples of today. Realizing that there are differences among the so-called Malayan peoples, I think we can say that the early Malayan population in general was to be found, first of all, rather close to the coast and then pushed back later into the interior, that they lived in rather small, independent villages, their houses raised high above the ground on piles, surrounded by fields in which they raised rice and sweet potatoes and other products. That these people had no idea of government larger than the village. That you had, in most cases, the village headman surrounded by a group of elders, and that they carried on the government on the basis of the customary law. The general life of the people is very much of the type that I have mentioned, a village life with no idea of state beyond the village, people living by agriculture, expert metal workers, people who had a very highly developed idea of spiritism. They had a very large number of spirits. They talked to these spirits through mediums. And during the seances or the ceremonies, the spirits would come and enter the bodies of the mediums, and the people were then possessed, and they no longer were human beings, but were the spirits themselves. Now that goes on today. Among many of the primitive tribes, of the non-Christian, non-Mohammedan tribes, these spiritualistic ceremonies are carried on up to the present. I have spent many days and many nights with these spirits. I have talked to them, seen a great deal of them, and they have an extremely important part in the life of these people. Also, a highly developed idea through most of the Malayan peoples is the idea of magic. The idea that man has more than one spirit, that these spirits are resident in various parts of the body. If these spirits are wandering and anything happens to them, then that happens to the individual. Now, if it is possible for the spirit of an individual to wander, it is also possible to lure them away, and it is possible to coerce them. And so you have the practice of black magic, the luring of a person's spirit, and practicing evil on that. And you have the idea of the medium who sends out her spirit and brings back the wandering spirits and practices counter magic. And in the same way that individuals have spirits which can be coerced and lured away, so also do animals and trees and plants. And so you can control nature by certain magical acts. And this has to be taken into consideration in practically anything when you attempt to understand the life of many of these tribes. The Indian traders came over here, certainly as early as the beginning of the Christian era, to trade along these coasts. And this became so prosperous and so desirable that they came in greater and greater numbers. Just when this trade started, we cannot say, but we do know that it was well established by the second or third century. We find that as these people came in, it was desirable for them to make certain stations, to make contracts with some of the local people so that they might, as they came by in their craft, have places for stopping and going and coming. Finding no organized government, finding nothing stronger than the village, it was a very easy task for these petty princes to take two or three villages and form them into a petty state. And in a little while, the coast leading through the Straits of Malacca and out into this region were dotted with these petty states. And then these petty states warred against each other to control the spice trade. And they were more and more drawn together until somewhere about the 4th century, there came into existence down here near the present town of Palembang in Sumatra, there came into existence a very powerful Indian Malayan state known as Sri Visaya. I find that in general, when you talk about great empires of Southeast Asia and use such a term as Sri Visaya, you get a rather blank look. But it was one of the most powerful empires that this part of the world has known. They had their trade relations with China, with Indochina. They dominated the trade over here to the Spice Islands. They had their trade with India, and they had their navy to protect this trade, and it was a very high and a very elaborate court. Little by little, they had other courts established, Mataram in Java and elsewhere. They had minor courts, and these sometimes became strong enough so that they attempted to rebel against Sri Visaya. In the beginning of the rule of Sri Visaya, the people were of the Brahmanistic faith. But the great rise of Buddhism in India soon had its repercussions over in this part of the world, and we have the tremendous competition between the Brahmanists and the Buddhists in the building of great structures in this part of the world. It was a period of great religious activity, of great religious structures that were carried on under Indian influence. But we haven't time to go into the details here, more than to indicate that this state of Sri Visaya and its satellite states built up contacts with China and with the regions to the north. This was partially for trade. Also, in the height of the Sri Visaya's days, in the 8th and 9th century, the Buddhistic faith was strong enough here so that there was a great Buddhistic seminary. And at least at one time, there were as many as 2,000 Chinese scholars studying Buddhism in Sri Visaya. And at another time, shortly after this, the ruler of Sri Visaya built a cloister at Nalanda in the Ganges Plain for the pilgrims from this part of the world. Well, these contacts and trade built up a very powerful state. Then there were many petty wars. One of the most disastrous wars, and one which had one of the greatest repercussions, was with China. China at times was very aggressive and laid to claim to sovereignty over this whole region. Some of the neighboring states began to fall before the Mohammedans. I'll bring that up again in just a moment, but I would like to stop here for the more important thing that I've been leading up to as a brief appraisal of what Indian influence has meant in this part of the world. First of all, they brought to the people an idea of state. And perhaps I should have said in the earlier words that in comparatively late times, there has been a steady infiltration of the Tibeto-Burman speaking peoples into Burma and into this region, and from the borders of what we now think of China, of people like the Thai speaking and other groups. People who physically are very much like the people of this region. But India brought to this region the idea of state to a people who had nothing larger than the village. It brought the idea of powerful rulers. It brought the idea of caste. It brought trade, tremendous amount of trade, largely because of the spice. It brought literacy to the ruling group, a form of writing known as Kawi. It brought in very advanced arts and the architectural work of this period excelled anything that this part of the world has known. And so we might go on, touching on the things which we think of as representing civilization brought here by the Indians during these days which we have mentioned. And yet, it appeared very much as a veneer. The village life went on quite undisturbed below all of this veneer. The Desa, or the village of Java, was very little affected by all of this change which went on at the court level. I spoke of the incoming of the Mohammedans. The Arabs were coming into this section even before the fall, even before their conversion to Mohammedism. But after their conversion to Mohammedism, they opened the way for the teachers. And very quickly, the Mohammedans spread their faith along the coast. And they took over many of the petty courts. And as the rulers would accept Mohammedism, the people followed suit. Until you had Mohammedism sweeping through this region very rapidly indeed. Just a word about Spain. Spain was not content with the great discoveries in the New World, but as you know, made a start for the Spice Islands. And under Fernando Magellan, they started across the Pacific. How any fleet, even the size of Magellan, could have come clear across the Pacific and missed all the Pacific Islands until they got to the Philippines is difficult to tell. But they came in here and discovered the Philippine Islands, and there weren't any spices there. And then a strange thing happened. That every little while, they got interested and did make a few forays down into this direction, but it was pretty sporadic, and as the Portuguese and the Dutch both called it, it was piracy. But they did find in the Philippines a very fertile field for colonization, because not too many Spaniards went there, but to bring the people into villages and for Christianization. It became almost a religion with them to bring the people down out of their scattered villages, put them into larger towns around the churches, and almost at once the work of the conversion to Christianity took place. At first it was wholesale. They would get the head man to accept Christianity, and you will read in many cases where the priest will say, "I have this day for the glory of God and for the King of Spain, I have baptized 1,500 people." I don't think they knew in the beginning very much of what it was all about. But little by little, and they didn't try to destroy the old, they simply incorporated it. But little by little, they added the ideals of the new faith. And around the churches, the people did gather. A modification, at least in portion of the building, of the colonial architecture of the Spanish period appeared along through the Philippines. You have the growth of the great churches, the building of roads, the opening of a certain number of schools, and altogether, the people were brought into something closer to civilization than most of the people of this part of the world. The total result, of course, has been that the Philippines have been the only Christian nation in this part of the world. Well, we haven't time to go into the story of their conflict with the Mohammedans in the southern Philippines, with the so-called Moros. That was a very real task and a constant task of the Spanish. They never thoroughly conquered the Moro, and the Moro problem is still very real, because the people of these of the southern islands here, particularly along the coast, are largely Mohammedan today. Another thing which happened with in the Philippines with the coming of the Spanish was the great influx of Chinese. They made the country fairly safe. The Chinese came in great numbers to trade, and soon they made themselves indispensable to the Spanish. On the other hand, they were so aggressive, they were so successful, and came in such numbers that the Spanish very frequently would become suspicious, and there were several terrible massacres. But the Chinese would come just the same. And they came in such numbers and stayed in such numbers that they make a very respectable portion of the population, particularly of the cities of the Philippines today. But here we have an interesting situation. The Chinese, in some of the larger cities like Manila, have their Chinese units today. But in general, the Chinaman has thrown his lot with the Filipinos. They've intermarried with the Filipinos, and their children are Filipinos. And a large part of the Filipino leaders have a considerable amount of Chinese blood. And there's very little in the way of a Chinese problem here in the Philippines. The legacy of Spain can be taken over then largely with the idea of the introduction of Christianity, introduction of a certain type of architecture, a partial literacy. They found no organized governments, so were quickly able to establish the rule of Spain, particularly along the coast. But for a very long period, this was a veneer which, in many cases, slowly worked its way down until it was a very real thing. But even up until today, in many places, the influence of Spain still is pretty much in the way of a veneer. Now to go rather quickly to the situation in Holland. When the Dutch came into this part of the world, and they established at various places like Acheen and Palembang and other places a series of stations to protect the spice trade over from this area. And in order to protect this, they made deals with some of these native states which had come in under Indian influence. And if a native ruler didn't go along with the company, they found ways of getting rid of him or aiding a rival. Until in a little while, they so antagonized the rulers, the native rulers in some regions, that they had open rebellion. And they soon found themselves in a position where they, although it was not intended in the beginning, they found themselves as virtual rulers in many sections of the Indies. It can hardly be said that the Dutch East India Company was operating in this part of the world for philanthropic reasons. They were there for money. They were there to get everything out of it the country could bear. And they used the native rulers just as far as they could as tax gatherers, and particularly to keep this spice trade moving. The situation got so desperate, there were so many rebellions, that finally the Dutch government had to take over the Dutch East India Company in 1798. They promised immediate reforms, but just after that, you will recall the Napoleonic Wars came on, Holland was taken over for a time, and the British moved in and took over the Indies. And a great British ruler, leader, by the name of Raffles, became the leader of this for the British in this region.